Music and Booze with Mo is co-produced and distributed by Nitty Grits, the media division of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, changing the world one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you in part by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers located in the Sunset Junction area of Silver Lake. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated selection of spirits, and one of the most impressive collections of bitters anywhere. That's Barkeeper in Los Angeles. Check them out online at barkeepersilverlake.com, or better yet, just head on down to the store. Today, my guest is the oh-so-distinguished Philip Dobard. In fact, he is the Vice President of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, the President of the Pacific Food and Beverage Museum, and the Director of the Museum of the American Cocktail. That's the one I care about the most, although all three are pretty interesting, as is Philip. So sit with us. We're going to learn some things about classical music, prog rock, and New Orleans food and drink, and I guess what it's like to have way too many jobs. Let's get going here on Music and Booze with Mo.
Let's start by saying hello.
Hello.
And we are doing the Music and Booze podcast, and today I am talking with... Introduce yourself.
Philip Dobard.
Yes. And what is your role in this world of ours?
Oh, Lord. I've so many roles. But
let's
in the context
of the cocktail thing.
In the context of this podcast, my highest and best billing is likely director of the Museum of the American Cocktail.
Have you ever been a bartender yourself?
Yes.
Yeah? When was that?
Let's move on. It was
a we're
good
not dating ourselves here,
30 years and change.
Wow. Was this like a college
job? I was in college. It was short-lived, and it is certainly pre-Renaissance. Pre-cocktail Renaissance, not the Middle Ages.
Well, that in a way leads to one of the reasons why I reached out to you to do this in the first place, because I was told that you were a classical opera singer at one point. So you
I was.
Renaissance and all of this.
I'm all that.
It all ties together. A true Renaissance man.
Oh, thank you.
So pre-Renaissance cocktails, yes, we have that. So you were just doing the and drinks.
It was, you know, if there was something aside from the maybe four or five, at best half dozen I knew, I would have to say, what's in that again?
So you found yourself better suited to be on the other side.
Oh, God, yes.
Of the bar.
Yes.
And what got you, thank you, what pulled you into this position that you're in now? How did you find yourself?
Oh, Lord, long story.
Becoming like this curator of...
Long story, but this is long form.
Tell the story.
So briefly, I grew up embedded in food and drink.
Because you're from New Orleans?
Well, not because I'm from New Orleans, because there are people from New Orleans who don't eat fish, which is really strange. But no, I happen to have grown up in New Orleans, and seemingly everyone but my mother and father were somehow, but even my mother, so I can't say that, was connected to food and drink. My father was an accountant. My mother was a bank manager. But my paternal grandmother grew up on a sugar plantation in Acadiana. My paternal grandfather, when he was growing up, he was on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain casting for shrimp.
Wow.
My mother's parents, she grew up on a farm in St. Bernard Parish in the community of Merrow. And M-E-R-A-U-X. Yes, this is Creole country after all. So Merrow, Louisiana. He became a farmer later in life, and so they moved to the country. And I had an uncle who was a brewmaster at Jackson Brewing Company, home of Jack's Beer.
Wow.
And Fabacher Beer.
Wow, you are not kidding. My
uncle by marriage, and uncle by marriage, he was harvesting whatever was in season. Brown shrimp, white shrimp, oysters, deer, duck, whatever.
Wow.
So our freezer was always filled with his bycatch. And his wife, my aunt and godmother, as it happens, she farmed soft shell crabs full time. So it wasn't until I was in my 20s and on my own that I knew what it was to have to pay for seafood.
Yeah, right.
but I wasn't interested in any of that.
You were as a
professional pursuit. No. Music. Rock and roll. And I took up guitar at an early age and got admittedly really good and wanted to study it in college.
What inspired you to take up guitar?
Oh, Lord.
The
Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Cream. Yes.
Yes.
Steve Howe. Greatest and most versatile guitarist
ever. Is there a song
ever
that like, comes to mind? Like you? Because, I mean, I have moments like that.
Going for the One.
That was the song that you remember hearing that, just being like...
But that was rather late in their early tenure, if you will. Mm-hmm. But Going for the One is...
But there's always a moment. There's always a musical moment. I didn't play
Yours
music.
Is No Disgrace.
Pardon?
Yours Is No Disgrace. That was my musical moment.
Was that Yours Is No Disgrace?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a moment... where you realize, you know, I love music so much.
Yes.
Or I want to be a musician because I want to learn how to play this, or it's a language I need to learn.
There are so many milestones.
There are.
One was when I had a little portable record player. That, which I would play 45s, because I think 45s is all
the way. They were only 45s on those little things.
And I remember being age 4 and listening to Beatles 45s and Monkees singles, knowing this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Wow.
So that would have been 1968.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yes, prog rock came a little later.
Yes.
But I think that's what made me want to be a great guitarist.
Was
more Steve Howe than Jimmy Page. Because my roots were not in the blues. And Jimmy Page, while I admired deeply admired his musicality and his virtuosity. It was Steve Howe's work that made me want to be a great guitarist.
So, you did that, and were you the first, more or less, in your family to steer away from the food and beverage world
I guess so.
You were like a rebel because we served music.
We had had non-food and beverage. But, you know, there weren't a lot of musicians in the family. In fact, the only one anyone can point to is my paternal grandfather's mother, who was a pianist in silent movie houses in New Orleans.
I would almost argue with you, because what I've found in talking with people in, and as you, knowing as many people in the food and beverage world yourself, would probably see the same thing, talking with folks and finding that there's a creativity that underlies it all. So you find great chefs play guitar.
Sure.
And, you know, great bartenders also, you know, are in bands.
The bartending and spirits world is
rife with musicians.
Rife with, I was going to use replete, but yes, rife with musicians and actors.
Yes.
Some of whom are just doing just bartenders to pay the bills, but some of whom are like, hey, you know what? I'm still on stage.
Yes, true.
I'm still doing theater.
They're performing sometimes. Right. Sometimes right. Performing, yes. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting in the tally of relatives that you listed here and their jobs, it seemed like a lot of them, they weren't necessarily on stage in what they were doing.
Right.
Because they were kind of more behind the scenes, more providers.
But they were still producing something for public consumption.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah, people say, what does a producer do? Well, a producer marshals the scarce resources that are people, money, and time in the service of storytelling. Okay, so that's still what they're doing.
And a meal is a story.
That's right.
And
it
a
is.
Drink is also a story.
Oh yeah.
So and songs are also very much a story.
Indeed.
Of course. So you became an accomplished guitar player, but that's not what you wound up doing.
No. So I went to entered conservatory as a jazz guitar major because rock guitar was not. Not a major instrument. So, and I'd studied jazz guitar in high school in part, just in order to prep for that. But while I was there, now I had sung classical music in a high school choir. I was blessed to have gone to a choir to a high school that had a preparatory college prep school that had a jazz band. I was the guitarist in the jazz band. I played football as well, but
how old were you when you first picked up a guitar? Do you remember?
It was fourth grade.
Fourth grade.
Or fifth grade.
Whatever that is.
Started taking lessons in fifth grade. You do the math. Please.
Yeah.
early, like 11. Age 11.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
So
you went in playing jazz guitar.
Yeah, went in playing jazz guitar. So I'd sung classical in high school in the choir. Blessed to go to a school that had a chorus that did great choral repertoire. I had a jazz band. That needed a jazz guitarist. So I stepped in, so I started studying jazz guitar. So it's like, okay, well, this all makes sense. So I knew something about classical voice, and I knew a little bit about opera because I started going to operas, attending operas in high school. So somewhere during my first semester in conservatories, I really discovered opera, and I said, oh, I want to do that.
You wanted to sing opera.
In that fashion. I wanted to sing in that way. I wanted to sing as a hybrid artistic athletic pursuit, which is what opera singing is.
Yeah.
And so I committed myself to that. Problem is I didn't have the instrument. I had a good instrument, but I didn't have a 3,000 seat house filling instrument.
I was going to say, you pursued it.
So...
You were going to be a Pavarotti.
Yes, I was not going to. So through my 20s, I made a modest living. I experienced modest success as an opera singer after graduating from conservatory. But by my late 20s, I discovered I was not going to be the next Domingo.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at a life of singing small roles in with regional companies, living out of a suitcase. And okay, so I don't want to do that. But I've invested all these years.
Typical musician life, though.
Very much so. But I'm not a typical musician.
Yes.
So I've invested all of these years in this art form, all of this energy, so what do I do? I produce it. What does that mean in opera? That means you're a general director of an opera company. But I didn't know a lot about doing that. I'd done a little producing in my 20s of theater and the like and concerts. And so graduate school. to get a degree in producing, a master's degree in producing, but being a glutton for punishment, I simultaneously picked up my Master of Music in Orchestral Conducting. two degrees at once.
So you can produce, well, it's all production, conducting.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Related.
Yes,
you're
indeed.
Basically leading the group.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Leading whatever you know, ensemble you have in front of you
yes.
into something.
Yeah.
Which you do currently also as director of the Museum of the
That's
American
right.
Opera. You just
That's
can't
right.
help yourself. You're a leader, Philip. Anyway, let's get back
and
to
And I
you,
wouldn't want to help myself. except to some French fries or onion rings. Which
yeah,
would be,
whichever,
very,
they,
okay.
whichever they bring
yes.
us.
Right.
So back to you. So you picked up
yes.
the double masters. And then
yeah.
once you did that, where did you go from? Did you conduct?
Well, I joined
did
the...
You,
yeah,
you
yeah,
sing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I had done a fair bit of conducting in my 20s, but without the training. Mm-hmm. You know, into my 30s, I still sang. I still gigged. Mm-hmm. But graduate school sort of took a hold of me. And I said, academia. Because I'm kind of all over the place.
Right?
Yes, thank you.
You're pretty welcome. And they got you wrong.
Oh, I got another one, yes. Thank you.
Can I for you?
Yeah, totally good. Thank you.
So, yes, this interview does take place over drinks and food.
Oh, gosh,
so.
Always.
So, cheers.
Double cheers. Here we are. At the fabulous 1886 in Pasadena, for those of you who are interested. Wonderful spot.
At the Raymond.
At the Raymond.
Yes, one of my... favorite watering holes.
Really,
holes.
It is.
One of my favorite watering holes in all of Greater Los Angeles.
Oh, for sure. This place is wonderful. I love this place. So I might backtrack a bit.
Yes, please.
Because you brushed over the fact that you did actually get out there and sing for a while.
I did. Yes.
And how long were you out there in the world performing as
well,
as an opera singer?
You see, I started when I was still a student.
Mm-hmm.
So
that makes sense. Though.
Age 21 to age 31.
Wow.
I was pursuing
That's
opera.
That's a good chunk of time to be...
10 years, yeah. But
yeah.
I graduated from conservatory at 24. But I'd been making a living. I became an AGMA member, American Guild of Musical Artists, so I was a teamster, if you will, from age 21. And but at 31, 30, 31, that's when I said, okay, what are you going to do? Now, I continued to sing. I continued to gig, but I refocused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
let's make sure you can edit any of this, but let's make sure we talk about guitar.
No, I want to talk about guitar.
Okay,
too.
All right.
So I'm just curious because you, as far as I know, are the first person who's ever sung opera that I've been an associate of. I do know who has done theatrical singing.
Okay.
Like Broadway
type
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that's a little bit different.
Yeah,
and,
I did some of that too.
Oh, of course, I did
what paid bills.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
Okay, so you had discussed singing opera as being athletic,
mm-hmm.
which I would think it is, because sometimes if I'm just enthusiastically singing along in my car to something that requires a little bit of effort,
yeah.
I can make myself a little bit wheezy.
Yes, yes. Now, imagine doing it to 2,000 to 3,000 people without amplification.
For an hour and a half?
3 to 4 or 5 hours, depending on the repertoire.
On what you're doing.
Yes.
How?
And acting, and acting, and in makeup, and a heavy costume.
How?
With a full orchestra.
How?
In front of you, not in back of you, in front of you.
How are there like large people who
well,
do this?
Well, the human instrument is the human vocal instrument yeah. is quite a piece of engineering.
Yeah.
And
do you think that you have to be not only born with the talent, but born with the set of lungs?
as it were.
I think about Adele, for example, who has quite a voice on
No,
her,
you don't
right?
have to be born with the talent,
okay.
but you do have to be born with the physiology.
Okay, maybe
yeah.
that's where
and
I
And that's
born.
One of the reasons I'm not speaking to you as an opera singer right now, is because I didn't have the physiology
wow.
or the physiognomy to be that singer. I was a good musical artist, but I wasn't a great opera singer because of the physical limitations.
Wow, that's incredible. So you were playing guitar also?
Yes.
So we can see?
So
look,
in high school,
bring it back to the guitar.
In high school, I formed a band. Mm-hmm. This was after an abortive 3 years as a football player. I started playing football in eighth grade, and I was the largest kid on the team.
Oh, really? Oh, but then you stayed the same?
By 10th grade, I was smaller than average. You look at me today, I'm the same size I was in 10th grade.
I'm the same size I was in eighth grade, but I'm a girl.
You know how many people wish they could say this?
Oh, I'm only saying in height. Really.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure I was much thinner.
So junior year, I joined a band. Sophomore year, end of my sophomore year, I joined a band. We formed a band. We didn't join. I didn't join a band. We formed a band. And we became a top 40 and oldies band, and this was 1980. Yeah, 1980. And
so were you doing those Monkees and Beatles songs then?
Yeah, we did some of that. We did a Monkees medley. We did a Beatles medley. We did all everything that was current, plus some older stuff, plus a few originals eventually. And I did the. We played all of the high school proms and weddings and. Vow renewal services and riverboats and nightclubs. Yeah. I was playing underage and all that. Classic New Orleans story.
Yeah. Yeah. but did you really want to have your originals band and do that?
Yes
prog
and
stuff?
No. Somewhere along the way, I discovered this opera thing.
Opera thing
like,
so.
That's what I want to do. And so after 3 years, I left the band and opera broke up. Opera split the band. Opera was our Yoko. That's right.
That's so classy of you, actually. Yeah. So you're going to go down. You know.
Ooh, Yoko the Opera. There's one on Jackie O. There's one on,
you're
you know.
You're a creative man, Phil.
There's Jerry Springer the Opera. You
oh,
know.
God, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm kind of horrified
Nixon
by that.
In China? I think we could do with, by John Adams. Standard repertoire now. Anyway, I think we could do Yoko the Opera.
What was her little disco song? Is it Walking on Broken Glass? Is that the song?
There was a Kiss.
Kiss, Kiss,
from Double Fantasy. Kiss,
but
Kiss,
she had,
Kiss,
Kiss
Me
solo
Now.
Record of hers, though. She had some, a little disco hit.
Post Lennon?
Gosh, that's it must have been Post Lennon. No? You know what? Maybe it wasn't.
Post Dakota Massacre?
I'm feeling like it was...
Nothing's off limits.
It's here. True. No. Actually, no. You're absolutely right. That's exactly what it was. I'm actually thinking it was CBGB era, so it would have been before.
Oh, before that. Okay.
It would have been before.
Yeah. Yeah, this ain't no CBGB.
I'm going to have to look it up and find out what it is and get back to you on that.
Yeah.
This ain't no CBGB.
You're welcome. This ain't no disco.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was lovely. let's jump back over to how you got involved in, you know, you've got this, you couldn't help yourself. You were born into food and beverage.
Yeah.
Yet you were,
it was embedded, embedded in it, but I didn't see it as a profession. It was just
music.
A way of being, yeah.
And now here you are as the director of the Museum of Cocktail. Now, how did that happen?
Okay, so here's how that happened.
Before we start that, though.
Yeah.
I want you to tell me what your favorite cocktail is. Do you have a favorite cocktail?
Okay. I answer that question.
This could change, much like your desert island.
I answer that question the same way I used to answer when I was an opera producer, what's your favorite opera? My standard response was, as if.
These things change depending on.
Okay, I would tell you that I have a favorite category.
Oh, okay.
And that is stirred aromatics.
I was going to say, I know you like big boy drinks.
If
we
you
joke
will.
We around about that.
Spirit forward.
Perfect. There we go.
Non-fruity spirit forward.
Now we
yes.
have our language
citrus,
straight.
Citrus-free spirit forward cocktails.
Yes, much like we're having right now. Yes.
I will drink a citrus cocktail. I will drink a shaken or built cocktail, of course.
But my
go-to is citrus-free spirit forward cocktails.
We could probably also call them like den cocktails.
Sure.
Library cocktails.
Stirred aromatics is what bartenders call them.
There we go.
Them. Yeah.
So that is your preferred.
Yeah.
And so now, okay, I'm just curious. I think as soon as you started to say that, I'm like, wait, I already know the answer to this question.
Yeah, yeah. So basically an old-fashioned, a Manhattan, a Boulevardier, those are
the ones that are
high in the mix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So how did you wind up doing what you're doing
okay,
now?
Okay, so in 19...
I know you do many things.
Yes.
But in particular...
In 1994, I went to graduate school.
Yes.
Started graduate school. And I was graduate assistant to a woman by the name of Liz Williams, who just about 10 years later founded the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Of course, Hurricane Katrina slowed that down. So the Southern Food and Beverage Museum didn't open until 2008. So I was her graduate assistant for a couple of years while I was getting those two master's degrees and 6 hours short of a PhD.
Oh.
Why didn't I finish? Because opera came calling. I got the opportunity to run a company in Florida, and I said, I can finish the PhD anytime.
Yeah.
That was 18 years ago. So much for that. Anyway, So I had moved out to, I'd migrated, in 2010 I migrated from theater production, full-time theater production, to film and television, which is what brought me to Los Angeles, what took me to Los Angeles. No sooner had I arrived here than Liz Williams came calling and said, hey, I think I may have that opportunity for us to work together again. Backstory, we had become colleagues eventually, and I joined the faculty at the University of New Orleans. She was president of the University of New Orleans Foundation, and we worked very closely together. And when I left to run this opera company, we said we were going to work together again at someday.
Yeah, yeah.
2010 came the opportunity. I said, well, listen, how's this going to work? I'm out here in L.A. producing film and television, and you're in New Orleans running what's now the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. She goes, hear me out. I said, okay. She said, I don't want to be just a New Orleans institution for all time. I would like to, in time, open other food and drink museums, say maybe in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
This is 2018. That was 2010.
Yeah.
Okay, so we started hatching that scheme. So in 2014, thereabouts, the Museum of the American Cocktail, which was founded in 2005, had been renting space from us in New Orleans, in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And in 2014, they came to us and said, hey, we're bartenders and historians. We don't know how to run a museum. You guys do, though. How about we merge?
Ah, and we said,
okay. So the Museum of the American Cocktail became a division of what is now the National Food and Beverage Foundation. We had to come up with this umbrella organization to house what Southern Food and Beverage. The Museum of the American Cocktail, the Museum of the American Cocktail, and what's now we've opened just recently, the Pacific Food and Beverage Museum.
Yes, and this is in San Pedro.
It is in San Pedro, which is the southerly most far-flung district of Los Angeles.
It is.
And home of the Port of Los Angeles.
So explain to me what the Museum of the American Cocktail is.
So the Museum of the American, the Museum
of the, yeah, the museum.
So it's a lot of words.
MOTAC.
But everyone has MOTAC.
MOTAC.
The Museum of the American Cocktail was founded in 2005 by Dale DeGroff, King Cocktail, and an assemblage of leading cocktailians of the decade. So
yeah,
David Wondrich, Phil Green, Robert Hess.
Wow.
And you go to the website, everybody else is there.
Yeah.
I'm not giving short shrift to anyone, but it's a lot of people.
Yeah.
They began life in New Orleans. The first location was, they actually did an exhibit in New Orleans. I mean, in New York.
In New York, because Dale's in New York.
Yes, he is.
And Dave's in New Orleans.
Dave Wondrich is New York as
he's
well.
He's New York as well, yes. Okay.
At Brooklyn. And in short order, they moved to New Orleans and installed the collection in the Pharmacy Museum.
Yeah.
And then they moved to Las Vegas. They were at the Aladdin. They were the
oh
collection.
My God,
the collection
really?
Lived within Commander's Palace, Las Vegas.
Wow.
Which is how T. Martin of Commander's Palace got credited as a co-founder.
Wow.
So, so Commander's Palace lost its lease to the Aladdin, so they went back to New Orleans, but inside the Southern Food and Beverage Museum.
Okay. Where's the Southern Food and Beverage Museum located?
Well, it's at the corner of Aretha C. Haley Boulevard. I'm sorry, Aretha C. Haley Boulevard and Martin Luther King Jr.
District is this?
Central City.
Okay.
Previously known as Faubourg Lafayette.
Wow. Why is it not known as that anymore for our New Orleans history lesson?
Because,
don't know.
You know,
has it been a long time since that changed?
A lot of people learn I'm from New Orleans, so they say, oh, do you speak French? No. I get by in French because I trained as an opera singer, but people haven't spoken French on the streets of New Orleans
for 150 years?
Outside of the French consulate. Exactly. since the teens, when the last, the last migration.
Somewhere.
It's like, no, dude, it's an American city.
It's such an odd American city, though.
It is.
But in the best way.
Yeah.
I mean, I always tell people when they're going to New Orleans for the first time, I'm like, New Orleans is such an amazing city. It's not like anywhere else in the world.
It's true. Mark Twain once said, New Orleans
is the only
American city where you can visit a foreign land without leaving the United States.
you visit several foreign lands without visiting, yes. You know. And I just tell people, I'm like, yeah, New Orleans is like, it's like everything. Basically, it's where the pirates settled, and it's still kind of like
right.
that.
But you know,
you could get stabbed for something, you could get robbed for something, but also you can find riches and glories galore.
New Orleans is a city of pathologies, and it is a city of cultural riches.
Yes, absolutely.
All of that.
Absolutely.
Los Angeles for a moment.
Yes.
Because a lot of people say, why did you
leave New Orleans?
Well, I did it for professional reasons.
Yes.
But why did you locate the Pacific Food and Beverage Museum in Los Angeles?
Because yeah.
Los Angeles is another one of those cities.
It is.
Where you can visit a foreign land without leaving the country.
It really is. So, it's a modern version of
that's
that.
That's right.
For sure.
Los Angeles is among a handful of global cities mm-hmm. where you can experience virtually any ethnic cuisine, both
oh my God,
unadulterated
absolutely.
And hybridized.
Absolutely.
So that
anyone who's familiar with Jonathan Gold, the food critic.
Yes.
Who is the biggest proponent of this, and I'm so grateful.
The only food writer to have won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yes, absolutely.
For literature.
Yeah, and that's something, I tell people that about Los Angeles all the time. Like, you know, one thing that I love about Los Angeles is you can start in one place, circle around it, and when you come back, it's completely different.
Yeah.
But there's always something to find.
For sure.
Yeah, always.
You can experience life as virtually any ethnicity, and then go back home to your middle class existence.
Whatever your middle class existence is.
And sleep tight.
Yeah. Absolutely. I totally agree with that. So bringing a food and beverage museum here makes sense.
Yes.
And the Museum of the American Cocktail in itself. So Museum of the American Cocktail implies that it is one museum encompassing all of America.
Alas. Not alas.
Okay.
Yet. It is not. The American cocktail is a global phenomenon. It is an American creation, if you will. It's a cultural icon that is now global.
Thinking the daiquiri, which is from Cuba. You know, there are drinks from other places, but...
Well, we didn't say U.S. cocktail.
No, absolutely. We did say the American cocktail.
It's a Western Hemisphere thing.
Okay.
Although one could argue the shandy, well, that's still the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah.
So we're safe.
So explain that to me. I find that very interesting. The Museum of the American Cocktail. So that kind of gets into like the history of the American cocktail. There's so much we can get into there. And is this something that the museum...
Okay. First off, no one knows where the first cocktail was made.
Oh, absolutely.
People say, oh, New Orleans. No.
Okay. Now, I'm not trying to diss your hometown with what I'm about to say, but I'm under the impression that New Orleans has laid claim to many cocktails that they didn't necessarily...
Yes, all of that.
Yeah, okay.
All of that. But, you know, every town in the Midwest...
But it is a town of pirates.
Every town in the Midwest says, we birthed the hamburger, when it did not. My Lord, it's ground beef.
Actually, there's a long story about the hamburger, and it does start in Germany, even if the actual form of the hamburger itself does not. It was more like a sandwich with ground beef in it.
The fact is... You know,
my family's German. I know these things.
People say, as is part of mine, people say, you know, jambalaya. It's unlike anything else. No, it's like fried rice in China, and it's like paella in Spain.
Totally.
Every culture has
a version.
A rice dish that salvages...
Leftovers.
That salvages leftovers. Mm-hmm. Every culture has a stew. Mm-hmm. That salvages leftovers. Gumbo. People get dogmatic about matters culinary.
Yeah.
And that's really out of place. Gumbo, what belongs in gumbo? Anything that's about to go bad.
So do you think then with cocktails, it's a similar thing? It's because the way that I used to think of cocktails before I got really into cocktails was... You drank beer because your water was bad. You drank wine because your water was bad. Mm-hmm. And you drank cocktails because you needed medicine. And there was this herbal liqueur.
Right.
And then you found out that it made you feel kind of nice.
Yes, that's right. Never mind that it was safer than water.
And it was safer than
water
as well.
In most places in the world.
But that's the thing. I've heard many theories bouncing around about
indigenous cultures in various parts of the world and tolerances to various kinds of spirits.
Yes.
And how those tolerances may be affected by the fact that they were not drinking these things like water because their water was safer or mm-hmm. something to that effect.
Yeah.
Because, for example, in Europe, it seems as if in the European cultures were drinking booze forever instead of water
mm-hmm.
because the water was so bad.
Yes. Never mind you that this distilling has its roots in a place that bans the consumption of spirits, the
Wait,
Middle
what?
East.
Oh, really? I
the
never
Muslim.
Knew that. I'm still just curious about the Museum of the Marian Cocktail and what kind of
yeah.
ambitions the museum has.
So we
I mean,
have
currently at the museum itself.
Yeah.
Or is that the Pacific?
Well, let me say this: the Museum of the American Cocktail. We made a decision several years ago to buy Focus the collections
okay.
in New Orleans. So in New Orleans, there's a collection of the Museum of the American Cocktail, the Motec New Orleans collection.
Yeah.
Now there is a Motec Los Angeles collection.
Oh, okay.
So everything that's not on display in New Orleans lives in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And we opened Pacific Food and Beverage Museum this past March. It'll be March of 2018.
Yeah.
And we are slowly revealing the Motec Los Angeles collection. We have many great exhibits
yeah.
planned.
Currently
many
there's a wonderful planned. Photography exhibit there.
Thank you,
I
yes, by Romney Caruso.
Yes.
And it's
bartenders and their tattoos.
Shakers, Knives, and Irons.
Yes.
It's an exhibit of large format photographs documenting the body art of celebrity chefs and bartenders.
Because we see it.
It's pretty special.
Even those Anthony Bourdain fans, he's covered in tats. You see that stuff.
That's right.
That's the thing. It goes with that creative personality,
That's
I
right.
think. You know?
That's right.
Mm.
Yes. I am inkless.
I am not inkless.
but I can appreciate the human canvas.
Yes. That's a wonderful way to put it. So, can you give us a sneak peek of what might be coming there?
In my line of work, in the course of my professional pursuits, I am bombarded with swag.
Oh, God, I'm sure.
With brand swag.
Yes.
So,
that's part of the deal.
You know, some of it's great. So we hold on to that swag. So we in time will mount an exhibit of
swag?
Brand swag.
I love that.
Pretty special.
Well, I'm feeling like we should kind of bring this back. And so we talked about music and
sure.
your role in it. We talked about the Museum of the American Cocktail and
sure.
your role in that.
I don't want it to sound like my musical, like my pop or prog rock musical development hit a sort of grand pausa in the late 70s because it
no,
did
no,
not.
No,
I'm still very much
yeah, what's,
into
what's something right now
what's current. Now, I still follow my sort of my musical formatives,
well,
if
yeah.
you will. So
that's,
I still follow Elvis Costello.
Oh, but Elvis Costello is a legend. I mean,
I still follow.
Do you have a favorite Elvis Costello, or is it hard to pick?
As if.
Yeah. Okay.
I still follow.
Fair.
I still follow. My lord, you're gonna have to cut this out.
It's because it's
the founder
quiz.
Of XTC.
Andy Partridge.
I still follow Andy Partridge.
So you like doing Stratosphere and
XTC,
all of that.
XTC, oh
yeah.
my lord,
yeah.
yes. Although
That's
he,
like nerd rock almost.
You know, he doesn't perform live.
There's a mathy quality to that,
yeah.
which goes with the prog rock thing.
Yes.
So I completely
Indeed,
understand
is.
Why
They're
that works
highly
out.
Constructed
yes.
music, yes.
Absolutely.
But,
do you like
but,
the Decemberists?
But with a pop.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Have you ever heard the Decemberists?
I know of them, but I don't
you,
know
You
them.
Might enjoy them as well.
I'm sure
They're
I've heard
in the indie rock realm, but they
yes.
very much have a
yeah.
a classical and intellectual.
So Talking Heads and then David Byrne, of
yes,
course.
Of
David
course.
Byrne, who's still very much with us.
Yeah.
Then, you know, the Crooners. Tom Jones is still with us. He's performing
yes.
a couple of weekends from now. We want this to live in perpetuity.
No,
so,
no, no. But you know what? I am
delete
a,
the
I'm
timeliness
a relatively young woman, and Tom Jones is someone I've never seen live and have always wanted to. Though when I came into this world,
he's
was,
at the Greek a couple of
He
weeks
was a
ago.
Little past his prime when I was born, but I do not care. Because from everything I've heard about Tom Jones, that man can still throw down.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, how old is he now? Is he like in his 90s?
920. No. He's in his 70s, I think.
But I mean, but he has a voice on him.
Oh, yeah. He's a Welshman.
Yes, he's a Welshman. I know.
Welshmen have a thing about singing.
He's so bombastic. And to be at this age, still being able to belt it out like that.
She still has the musculature to make it happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's amazing, because you hear
Welsh
many
pop
vocalists.
Singers, Welsh crooners, Welsh opera singers. It's a thing. It's a phenomenon.
What is it with Wales? It's like this big. It's this big. I'm making a hand gesture that's like a pinky, not even a pinky. It's like the smallest O ever.
They annually host. Is it annually?
Annually is
anyway,
once a year.
Anyway, it's periodic. A competition called the Greatest Singer in the World competition.
In Wales?
In Wales, in Cardiff.
Okay.
Cardiff. And let's just say Welshmen now and again win it.
Wow. I mean, because that guy, like I said, thinking about you in the operating, I hear when I hear Tom Jones perform currently, I'm astounded.
Yeah.
I'm like, how does this man not pass out doing this? And you look at him and he looks great.
Physiognomy.
There you go.
Or physiology. I'm going to have to check and get back to the to our audience.
We've had a couple of drinks. Maybe it is time to wrap this up. Okay, so we've got that you like Stewart Aromatics. Give me a couple favorite songs of yours or favorite albums of yours.
Flagpole Sit-Up.
What?
Harvey Danger.
Oh my God.
Late grunge.
Flagpole Sitta. Yes.
Late grunge.
I was thinking you were going to say some prog thing.
Flagpole Sitta is what hooked me
into
back
like modern
into
rock.
What's
Are
happening
you
in modern rock?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So that's one of your, at this point, a record that you can't live without, right?
Harvey
now.
Danger.
Wow.
That's
so unexpected, and I love
that. It's a crime that Harvey Danger is not central to our musical culture.
Yeah, yeah. But the music
nerds anyway,
love them.
Flagpole said it is what said, hey,
come
you
back.
Need to pay attention. It's what said come back.
Come back.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. I love that. Okay. Let's leave on that super surprising note. That means I'm going to close this show out with a track from that record. You know that, right? That's okay. Thank you so much, Philip. This was super fun.
You are
so,
most welcome.
Yeah, we're sitting around having drinks, talking about music and booze. It's all good. And everyone listening, I'll give you more information about everything we talked about after we sign off. Thank you so much. God damn you.
So I guess you'll have to do a little bit of research on this one because we talked about a lot of fun places to visit. You can visit if you're in New Orleans anyway, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, which is at 1504 Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard. Or if you're in California, the Pacific Food and Beverage Museum is at 731 South Pacific Avenue in San Pedro. Head on over to the National Food and Beverage Association online and you can get all kinds of information about all of these things. You can find out about the Museum of the American Cocktail, which hosts events all over Los Angeles and New Orleans. You can find out about these other museums. Very interesting stuff with really great seminars, events, etc. Lots of fun. So check it all out at the National Food and Beverage Foundation website. Thanks so much to Philip DeBard for joining us and educating us on all of the above and just being a darn entertaining person. And if you want links and all of that, head on over to my Facebook page, that is Mo Herms on Facebook, and I'll provide a bunch of it in the description for the show. Thank you for tuning in today. There's lots more to come. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you in part by The Blind Rabbit, a speakeasy located in the Anaheim Packing District. The Blind Rabbit has twice been given Best Mixology Awards by the OC Register, as well as several nominations for their innovative cocktail program. For more info and to make reservations, go to theblindrabbit.com. Thanks for tuning in to our Barroom Chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guests and our Spotify playlist, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.